Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... Listener, we were thinking about calling this the Everything's a Metaphor episode, because even when we Israelis have something to celebrate, it's always complicated. Israel wins a gold medal, its second ever at an Olympic Games, thanks to a halachically non-Jewish immigrant who's not allowed to marry his girlfriend in Israel. The mixed men's and women's judo team wins a bronze medal on Shabbat, at a time when the religious affairs minister says that having men and women serve together in the IDF does more harm than good. And the American Jewish ringers on Team Israel's baseball team go out with a whimper, after capturing the imagination of a handful of expats and absolutely no one else. Meanwhile, Israel became a world leader in another field this week, launching a campaign to give over 60s a third COVID vaccine shot, arguably for political rather than public health reasons. Joining me to discuss the symbolism and irony of Israel's sporting glory, what it says about Israeliness and the vaccination drive, we've got Noah Landau and Anshul Pfeffer. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Simon.
Hi, up.
So, look, there's a lot to unpack here, but let's start with Artyom Dolgopyat's sensational gold medal in the men's artistic gymnastics floor event at the Tokyo Olympics. Israel's second ever gold medal, its first since 1966, and the first it's won in one of the core disciplines at the Games. An Israeli success story through and through, right?
No.
No?
This is a medal which... Should be dedicated to the Russian-speaking Aliyah, the million-plus who came here over the last 30 years from the former Soviet Union. Without them, not just because Artyom Dolgopyat was born in Dnipropetrovsk and began training there as a six-year-old in gymnastics and only came here when he was 12 and really had no interest in anything but finding a gym where he could continue training, but he was... continuously surrounded by fellow members of that wave of immigration. His coach from Dnipropetrovsk came to Israel after him. The coach who met him here, he was introduced already, the connection was already made before he came. And you know, he said in an interview that I read on the internet that he never went to an ulpan and he only learned Hebrew in the gym, but even in the gym most of the time he was hearing people around him speaking Russian. And you know, anybody who watched his interviews, the way he carries himself, the way he responded to his incredible achievement, the kind of reserve, and the, you know, the first thing he said was my routine wasn't very good, and you know, I made mistakes but other people made mistakes as well, and therefore I won the gold. There was something so not Israeli in that. And you know, we all, I think we all of us watched it live, and I think someone tweeted, one of our colleagues tweeted, they never saw the Haaretz newsroom so patriotic. So this is a win for Israel, but we have to really keep this in context. This is a very specific Israeli community from which Artyom comes, and you know, we should be paying them respect right now.
Mm. You're such a party pooper, aren't you? I mean, in the end, they did train here, you know, for the Olympics. No one knows what would have happened if, you know, they stayed in Ukraine. And I also think that, you know, in general, the Olympics, most of the games are individual, right? It's always someone individual who wins because of his or her specific circumstances. There are other people in the Israeli delegation who have, you know, unique stories and came from everywhere around the world. But in the end, you know, it's the balance between the individual achievement and the fact that the country wants to see it as a national victory as well. And, you know, truth is somewhere in the middle. So I do think it is an achievement that I'm happy that Israelis are happy about and they actually see it as their own.
Mm. The question is whether they will look beyond the sporting triumph of the moment. I mean, this almost feels like the antithesis of an Israeli success story. And it's the, you know, the not by the seat of your pants improvised, it'll be okay approach that Israelis are so famed for. But as you said, something more reserved, something more modest, something almost anti-Israeli.
Look, the Israeli system failed him. He dropped out of two high schools. He hasn't had any schooling since age of 16, though he still had to go to the army as a...
Israeli taekwondo fighter was actually born in Israel.
Exactly.
Also didn't go... Also, you know, didn't attend school much because sports was more
part
important.
But she was part of a much wider system which boosted her and took her to this moment. So I think we have to keep that in focus. And look, people were saying, you know, why are only now people talking about that he can't get married here? There were 440,000 mm-hmm. Israelis who are officially classified as without religion who can't get married here. And let's remember, none of us can get married here if we don't want to get married in a religious ceremony. There is no civil marriage here. So all of a sudden, because of one guy, we're talking about this, and that's a good thing. We should be talking about this. But why haven't we been paying the attention to all these kids who come here at the age of 10, 11, 12, aren't absorbed, that wonderful Israeli word, klitatu, they're not absorbed into Israeli society. So Altium, he has his incredible both abilities and his incredible work ethic. And thanks to that, he's now Israel's gold medal winner. But, you know, we're not looking at the wider picture here.
Mm. And as you say, perhaps when one person becomes the face of an issue, this is something that will be looked at a lot more. Like, as you wrote about, Anshul, the grandchild clause in the law of return that allowed Altium to come to and to make Aliyah. And then you've got Bezalel Smotrich tweeting, very known to be opposed to that clause, saying that he can finally join the celebrations because the medal wasn't won on Shabbat. So putting this into the public eye is perhaps the greatest service that we could expect from this medal victory.
I think these things bring things up to the surface. So first of all, it's a wonderful... I don't want it to make to sound... Noah justifiably accused me of being a party pooper. I don't want it to sound as if I wasn't there with everybody else on my sofa cheering when he won, and especially cheering when the American and the Chinese and the Korean gymnasts all made their misses and slips during their routines. I was there, and I don't need to make this excuse, but I was. I love sport. I wouldn't say that I follow gymnastics in between Olympics, but everybody who loves sports, that's the beauty of the Olympics. We suddenly start following these very obscure fields because that's what we do every 4 years. Mm. But this brings to the surface these things, and the fact that Altium's mother, I think, posted on Facebook yesterday evening that, with all due respect, my son can't even get married in this country. That has to be something at the forefront, I think.
Mm. On the other hand, when he was interviewed about what his mother said, it sounded like, I'm not sure he actually wants to get married. It was more his mom just, made him marry, on national radio, and he's not quite sure he wants to talk about it.
But is it possible that this case could shame the government into doing something about it? I mean, it's already shown that it's got the balls to take on the rabbinate over kashrut, so maybe civil marriage could be thrust back onto the agenda?
If it will, then this is the perfect time, because this is, a rare government without the ultra-Orthodox parties. So if someone, Avigdor Lieberman, who actually, this was his campaign for so long, if he wants to launch again the initiative, this is the perfect time.
Mm. Any indication that he does want to? I mean, I know the coalition agreement between Yesh Atid and Yamina doesn't include any clauses about advancing civil marriage, and it's, moreover, it says that no reforms will be enacted to change the status quo on religion and state unless there's an agreement within the coalition. Is there a chance that we could see a cross-coalition agreement on civil marriage?
Well, several times we were pretty close to some kind of understanding, but just regarding those people like Artyom who are considered to be religious-less, and those specific people, it might be relevant to them that we will see some kind of a reform that will allow that specific group to marry. I don't think that in general, I wouldn't say that there's a lot of chance, to see something bigger than that. But I also think that, we saw yesterday after Artyom's mother's wedding announcement, then we saw that also a minister from Yesh Ated, Yoel Razbozov, tweeted very, angrily that that Artyom is a pride on the podium, but a second-class citizen when it comes to marriage. So like Anshil said, it did raise the issue. I'm not sure that we'll see, because of what you said, because of the coalition agreements with the Amina, etc., I'm not sure we'll see something big. But regarding people who are religious-less, I think it might be a possibility.
Mm. I think that it's important that this becomes more and more part of the public discourse. I don't think that this government, at this stage, when it's still new, it's still got a massive fight on its hands just to pass the budget, which the cabinet approved early this morning. I think there are other things on its agenda first, but if this government survives and makes it to its next budget and there's more time to discuss some of these things, I think there is a chance that we'll be seeing perhaps probably not civil marriage for everyone, but certainly some kind of arrangement for those 440,000 Israelis without classified as without religion.
Mm. What, a bypass the rabbinate law?
Perhaps some kind of, it was called Brit Zugiyut, a couple pact. There'll be some kind of arrangement, hopefully. And
right.
It's a long fight. We haven't had civil marriage here for 73 years. It's not going to happen tomorrow.
Right. But in Israel, anyways, you can live as a couple and get all the rights, benefits, or whatever, not that there are so many, but, that exist for people who are married. You can still live this way in Israel without really officially being married.
On a municipal level.
Not only, I think, also regarding government ministries, regard you as a couple, if you have an arrangement of being known as a couple, or however you call this legally. So it's not a huge step, to take this. One step forward and call it Brit Zugiyut, how would you translate Brit Zugiyut?
Couples pact.
Yeah, which is what Avigdor Lieberman suggested in the past.
Mm. There are three other non-Jewish Israelis competing under the Israeli flag, which raises more issues about what is Israeliness, what is Israeli citizenship and identity. Hana Minenko, Lona Salpeter, and Selamawit Tafari are all non-Jewish women who received Israeli citizenship after marrying Israelis. Are they seen as more or less Israeli than Artyom if they were to win a medal?
I think yesterday when Hana Minenko was in the final of the triple jump, just gauging by the amount of Israeli television attention she was receiving, she didn't win a medal, so obviously the result wasn't the same.
Incredible sixth place.
Fantastic sixth place. Her third Olympic final. For any athlete, that's a huge achievement. I think she was getting a lot of attention. She was being treated as one of us. But it's a very interesting phenomenon. The moment you're wearing that blue and white outfit and you're competing, and there's a chance that you may get a medal and it'll be the Israeli flag and it'll be on the podium, and if you get a gold, there'll be the national anthem. That suddenly makes you one of us. It's so easy. All you need to be is being an extremely good athlete. But the rest of the time, someone like Hana Minenko may not have been able to get Israeli citizenship. She, as it was, those three women, those three fantastic female athletes you've mentioned, had to go through rather difficult bureaucratic hurdles to become Israeli citizens. It's not an easy situation. And I think we should compare it with the ease with which a group of burnt-out ball players who were making up something what's called, in quote marks, the Israeli baseball team, they kind of dropped by, picked up their citizenship and went back to America. And when you compare that to people who've really worked, sweated blood to both be Olympic champions, baseball team's not going to win anything, obviously, and and to be Israelis that actually live here and to invest their lives here. So they're not Jewish, but they're married to Israelis and they want to live and they want to be part of Israeli society. You know, there's something wrong with the law of return, which allows people who have no connection whatsoever to Israel, besides having some kind of Jewish ancestry and have no intention of living here, like 20 of that 24 strong baseball Israeli in quote marks team, there's something wrong when that's the situation, when people like Hana Minenko and the others have to go through to jump through so many hoops to be Israeli citizens, when they're married to Israelis and they want to live here and spend their lives here.
Well, jumping through hoops is exactly the phrase.
So you mentioned Team Israel, which is made up of those predominantly Jewish players from the States. Maybe Jewish is the more correct way of calling them. And you wrote that it makes a mockery of Israel's citizenship laws. And there are so many areas in which this is a mockable set of laws, right? And from the reunification law to the right of return, is this something that is now going to be on the agenda?
No. The law of return is kryptonite. Nobody wants to touch it.
No clause of it, not even as we mentioned, the grandchild clause?
Well, it's interesting because the grandchild clause was something which was suggested by Bezalel Smotrich from the far right. Now, usually it's the right wing who are much more anxious about don't touch the law of return and so on. And I don't think the law of return should be cancelled, but I think the problem with the law of return, certainly in the 21st century, when people are so mobile, is that you can just pop over and pick up your citizenship and leave immediately, and it's an automatic law. Now, the law was not made to allow oligarchs to have some kind of tax haven or to allow washed out baseball players have another chance of playing on a big stage if they do not intend to actually live in Israel. The law was made because Israel was established as a haven for the Jewish people. As a haven for Jews, not for the entire Jewish people. Zionism doesn't say anywhere that Israel has to replace the diaspora and every single Jew in the world has to live in Israel. The idea is it's a home for Jews who want to live there. So.
And it was a response for the Nuremberg laws,
yeah,
of course.
Exactly. That's why the ground floor clause is there. Mm. But the idea that people would come here, pick up their citizenship, pick up their passport, their ID card, then become officially Israeli, and then immediately leave, never featured in the minds of those who were drafting the law back in 1949, 1950, when the law was originally passed. And the baseball is more of an amusing anecdote, but it's being used by tax dodgers, it's being used by oligarchs, it's being used by actual criminals on the run. Mm-hmm. And this is something which needs to be, which should be fixed, but nobody really wants to touch the law.
Mm. And perhaps the ultimate ringer would have been Albert Einstein as president of the State of Israel. He fortunately turned it down, I think we can say fortunately, right?
No, he would have come here and lived here, that's different. If... Look, we had the case with Stanley Fisher, the former director of the Bank of Israel. He was tapped. He was a very, very respected economist and central banker. They brought him in. He got automatic citizenship, but he spent years here working as the governor of the Bank of Israel. That was something that actually meant something. He wasn't a guy trying to make it in the minor leagues in baseball in America, just popping over to get his permit to play in the Israel baseball team. Or one of these oligarchs that we know who have Israeli citizenship just so they can have a bolt hole if Putin suddenly wants to put them in prison. They can rush over and stay here.
But on the other hand, actually, I mean, in sports in general, it's not only the Olympics and national teams. In sports in general, foreigners come to strengthen, different teams. And it's something that, we see all over the field, basically. And they're immediately regarded, as part of the team, even though they just came from I don't know where.
But perhaps it's more disturbing when there is a potential pool of Israeli citizens to be tapped into for such purposes. I'm talking about the 20% of the country who are Arabs. Now, we've mentioned Haaretz 21 on the podcast before. Remind listeners, that's the project which aims to amplify underrepresented voices and stories of Arab-Palestinian communities within Israel. I know there are a lot more pressing issues on the minds of Arab-Palestinians in Israel, such as making sure that more than 10% of the content of official government websites appear in Arabic, for example. But did any of the writers that you're in touch with have anything to say about the total absence of Arabs in the Israeli delegation to the Olympics?
Well, of course, there were a lot of conversations around this issue, specifically this week. And, you know, part of the issue is, of course, that there isn't enough, you know, investments in terms of not only money, but also, you know, looking for young potential and encouraging sports and et cetera in most of these communities. Mm. But also, on the other hand, there's a question of, you know, as you said, things are more urgent. And sometimes, you know, it's not the most obvious choice for parents and children to choose this path when they actually, you know, need to survive socially and financially in Israel. So we see that, you know, a lot choose professions that are considered to be more promising and stable. Mm-hmm. So there's that's more, you know, on the sociological side of things. There's also, I think, a smaller but still relevant question of wanting to be part of a national team and represent Israel with everything that it means and the flag and etc. So, you know, it's pretty complex.
Mm. In team sports, I'm thinking primarily of soccer here, football, there are...
Was that strange word you used?
Sorry, I slipped into my American there. I'll translate into English. That's footy. there are several Arabs on the Israeli national football team.
There have actually been some games in recent years where a majority of the Israeli football team on the pitch were Arabs. Mm. And it's interesting, maybe no one knows why. Why are they so eager to be part of the Israeli football team, but not to be on the Olympic delegation?
Football is big in general. You know, I'm not an expert of this sociology of sports, but I do think that football, you know, all over the world is probably very popular
among Palestinian Israelis.
Populations that are, you know, on the sidelines of society.
But interesting that Palestinian Israelis are interested in being part of the Israeli national team when it comes to football. So that's, to me, it's always been a fascinating phenomenon.
Well, first of all, it's very complex. There are always stories, right, about, you know, the anthem. And, you know, we just now there was an issue with one of the players around the events in Al-Aqsa, where he had to, you know, release a statement about how he opposes what the Israeli army did in Al-Aqsa. And then, you know, it was difficult for him within the team. And there were a lot of comments on that. But football is quite unique, I think, for the Palestinian Arab society within Israel.
I agree. Football is always unique.
Yeah, guys, should we move on to the second part of our discussion today? But don't worry, Israel's still first in the world on this stage as well. First, that is, to give its population a COVID vaccination booster shot. Incidentally, our colleagues Amir Tibon and Alison Kaplan-Summer are hosting a Zoom meeting with Professor Ran Balicher, where they'll be discussing the public health aspects of the booster campaign. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, at 8 p.m. Israel time, 1 p.m. Eastern time. Listener, check haaretz.com for details. But I'd like to ask about the decision-making process, though. Would it be fair to say that the decision to give over 60s a booster shot was made even though the science isn't unequivocal at this stage?
That's true. The science isn't conclusive on the need for a third booster shot, and it's not clear exactly how effective the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which is the one being used in Israel, is effective against the Delta variant, which is the one that, you know, that we're facing now. On the other hand, the science does say that there are no serious side effects which can be expected. So if it can't do that much good, it can't do much harm. And there are indications that it could work. Pfizer certainly claim it could, though. Who's going to trust Big Pharma, obviously? But I think what we've seen here is a very interesting way of decision-making in Israel. And Nahu, who was diplomatic correspondent throughout part of the pandemic, remembers, you know, covering the interminable meetings of the COVID cabinet, or the corona cabinet, and how it was basically Netanyahu making decisions on his own. Nahu, correct me if I'm wrong. But here we saw what looked like more or less an organized decision-making process in which the health ministry's advisory committee, which is about 60 experts on epidemiology and various related fields, sat for two very, very long meetings, and everyone had a chance to say what they thought, and then they delivered their recommendation. Then the recommendation was taken up by the Director General of the health ministry, and only then the cabinet voted and approved it. So I think at least we can say that the decision making here was better organized, even if the decision is, nobody can say for sure it's the right one, because we don't really know what this third dose is going to do. And also we don't know for sure how much really the effect of the vaccination taken by older Israelis already by now 6 months and more ago, if that has really waned to a point where it needs a booster.
Mm. I mean, was it a political decision at all? And Bennett spent last year's lockdown writing a book teaching Netanyahu about how to defeat COVID, and then he finds himself being skewered by Netanyahu over his handling of the Delta variant.
Yeah, but I think what Anshil said about the decision-making process, that's, in the end, that's the essence. Because you can blame one person for, thinking about his own political future, but when there are so many people involved in this, and research, and, question being raised, and discussions in the cabinet, and the government, and the health ministry, they're not all concerned about Bennett's political future. They actually also, I want to think, care about the public. Mm. And they're not, it's not that cynical in the end. And also, I think we should remember that, for the first two shots, Israel was the first to launch such a wide national campaign. And we were told also back then that, it's political. But now when you look at it and you look at the world, of course taking these two first shots was the right shot. Mm. So, and we were also told even back then that the third one would probably be needed. So it's not that a surprise.
Mm. Are we heading for a Rosh Hashanah lockdown? Are more restrictions on the way? There have already been protests against the reintroduction of the green passport and the, what's it called? The happy badge?
Yeah, they're always replacing the names. It's hard to follow.
And how about a quick word for Matty Kasbi, guys, the Israeli singer who cancelled concerts at venues which insisted on all attendees being vaccinated, putting him in the same dubious company as Eric Clapton and Van Morrison?
I actually think that if you look at what's been happening in the United States and in Britain and in a number of other Western countries, we haven't seen here big anti-vaxxers movement. We haven't seen large groups based on their political affiliations saying we're not going to be vaccinated, we're not going to wear masks. Yeah, I mean, we had issues with the Haredi community in the previous waves about whether or not they would abide by the lockdown. But by and all, we haven't had this like big cultural issue about masks being, I'm holding up my mask now, masks being an infringement on personal liberties and the vaccine being some kind of devil's work. There is a small group of anti-vaxxers in Israel. They're more vocal than they are large. Most of the government policies, even when they were politically motivated, especially during the Netanyahu era, were directed by science. There were here and there issues that some things were done too late. There was too much of a centralization of powers within the prime minister's office, and so on. The health ministry didn't function very well. But like I said, by and large, science directed the government's policies, including the Netanyahu government and now the Bennett government. And most of the Israeli population has more or less been happy to go along with it. We've seen now a massive registration of over 60s for their third vaccines. So I think the Israelis are saying, we will go along with the government as long as things seem reasonable. I think that if a fourth lockdown on Rosh Hashanah, that may be a bit too much for the public to swallow. But I don't see the government heading that direction.
I don't think so too. I don't think a full lockdown is something that will. And also, the data doesn't really justify this. In the end, I mean, there's a lot of concern. But if you look at the actual numbers, of all kinds of data, people who are now ill, people who are infected, and so on, it doesn't really justify it.
Mm. And it's mainly amongst the unvaccinated, so maybe we should be focusing on the unvaccinated at this stage.
There's no question that the around about 700,000 Israeli grown-ups and who haven't yet been vaccinated. That is the part of the population which really need, you know, it's about 15% of the adult population. It's not a huge proportion, but that's also the most difficult part to get. It includes the anti-vaxxers, but it also includes people who sort of don't want to join in, people who are skeptical, people who have all kinds of issues, and also the numbers may be a bit misleading, because there may be a number of those who are abroad even. But there is a certain group that if they would vaccinate, then, you know, we'd be close to total vaccination and we would probably have herd immunity. But then who knows what's going to happen when another variant comes around? And we've seen the Delta variant can infect people who have been vaccinated to a lower proportion, but it's there. So, you know, we're living with this, yes, evolving virus that nobody can say for certain what's going to be the right thing to do with it.
So we're not being experimented on this time with the third shot.
I don't think we were experimented on at any point. You know, there were the medical experiments, you know, that were done without us. But maybe you can say that we were a showcase for something that was already experimented on.
That's probably a better spin to put on it than being experimented on. Guys, I'm afraid we're out of time for today. Thank you so much for joining me and for the fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. We'll be back again on Friday with another episode of Haaretz Weekend. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.